The series of lectures we're doing at the moment are entitled Insightful Thoughts on the Hebrew and Messianic Scriptures, Growing Spiritually as We Study Historically. And this is the third lecture in the series we're giving today. And I've subtitled it, Did Moses Really Author the Torah? Did Moses Really Author the Torah? William Deaver, an American biblical scholar and archaeologist, wrote a book entitled, Who Were the Early Israelites and Where Did They Come From? Back in 2003, on page 37, he writes, It is universally agreed that the book of Deuteronomy is a later addition to the Pentateuch. Probably it was inserted not earlier than the late 7th century BC. All right, so this is the general consensus now, is that Deuteronomy, and in fact the whole Torah, was not written by Moses. It was written years later after the Israelites had reached the Promised Land. They never were in Egypt. They just sort of arrived in the Promised Land, conquered the Canaanites, and rabbis and other scholars wrote the Torah and put the name of Moses on it. This is what's been taught in theological institutions today. Samuel Johnson said, Sir, I have found you an argument, but I am not obliged to find you an understanding. And that quote I have used often in past experiences, because you can find an argument to combat people, but you can't always open their understanding to accept it. You just can't. And Samuel Johnson understood that principle. And perhaps we need to think more about that too. Don't expect too much understanding from people, because once God enlightens you, that's one thing. But you trying to enlighten someone else, it's something else again.
Yeah.
And you're up against a brick wall on that one, because it's the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh, that opens the mind, not any of us. Matthew Arnold wrote, And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. And how much we are dealing now with people who are fighting and arguing against our principles, against our theology, and so on and so forth, in darkness, because their minds are not open. Yeah. So, the 19th century, it's come and gone, but it saw an enormous revival of biblical study and zealous missionary endeavours. It was the time of the great missionary awakening. I remember how many times when I was with FEBC, I would go around to different churches and talk about the great missionary awakening of the 19th century, when the China Inland Mission was opened by Hudson Taylor and all of that. But it did. The 19th century was a marvellous time for the awakening of Christians to spread the news, to take the gospel out, to evangelise people. They weren't afraid to do it. They took the gospel to countries and nations and peoples that had never heard the name, that one name under heaven, whereby we can be saved. You know? Never heard it. But out met the missionaries, all over the place. And they didn't fly to different places. There weren't any aeroplanes in those days. They took old ships, and they sailed all around the world with the gospel. Many of them perished at sea. But they went out, writ their Bibles, and took the gospel to people. And it's been called the Great Missionary Awakening, and not without reason. And it brought forth memorable individuals like Hudson Taylor, as I mentioned. He founded the China Inland Mission. The Prussian evangelist, George Mueller, who founded the orphanages over in Bristol for children. And Gladys Aylward, the little evangelical Christian missionary to China, whom Alan Burgess, an author, immortalised in his little humble volume called The Small Woman. And some of you may not have read the book, but I'm sure you saw the Inner of the Six Happiness way back in the... late 50s, early 60s, I think it was. And the end of The Sixth Happiness was all about her story. And it wasn't a movie that was geared to Christians. It was just a movie that was out there showing what a little woman could do in converting thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of Chinese to Christianity. Incredible story, The End of The Sixth Happiness. But that era, the 19th century, also brought forth great theological minds who gave a serious study to Scripture. And more than ever before, more than the 13th century, more than the 17th century, more than the 18th century, and more than the 20th century and 21st century. You know, we've gone into a post-Christian world. But the 19th century gave us Joseph Seitz. It gave us R.A. Torrey. It gave us E.W. Bullinger. Gave us John Nelson Darby of the Plymouth Brethren. And Darby gave us a beautiful Bible, which I have on my shelf in there. It also produced dynamic speakers, dynamic teachers and preachers like Charles Spurgeon and Dwight L. Moody. It was a time of incredible revival. The 19th century was a hive of solid Christian activity. The 19th century also saw another awakening, a very negative one, to counter the move of the Ruach HaKodesh. And it was started, of course, in Germany. In Germany. And a fellow called Julius Wellhausen, born 1844, died in 1918, produced what he called the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis. It theorized, because writing did not exist before 1500 BCE, ! You see, writing didn't exist back then, that was the very period that saw Israel leave Egypt. The Torah of Moses, therefore, could not have been produced in such a primitive age. Now, this was the reasoning, and everyone said, oh, of course. But I mentioned this fact as fact, because it's often conveniently overlooked by modern-day haters of God who still mindlessly follow this largely aberrant school of thought, because today we know quite well that writing was very much in vogue at that time. Absolutely. We know now, but they didn't know then. The discovery of 1,800-plus complete tablets and 4,700 fragments of Ebla clay tablets in Syria that date well past 2000 BCE is evidence enough. Here they are, all these tablets, thousands of them, all with writing and script. Human beings over the past 12 to 15,000 years have been devolving, not evolving. That's a fact. All modern scientific breakthroughs that we have today have been nothing more than rediscoveries of forgotten knowledge. Solomon understood this. You turn over to Ecclesiastes, chapter 1 and verse 9. The wisest man who ever lived next to Yeshua wrote this. In verse 9 of chapter 1, the thing that has been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. There is no new thing under the sun. Yeah, nothing new. Absolutely nothing new. He says, is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? You know, he anticipates an argument, Solomon. And he says, is there anything that of which it may be said, this is new? It's already been of old time, which was before us. Then he says, of course, there is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of the things that are done. Sorry, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after that. Indeed, that's because that's the cyclical or cyclical nature of history. Some bright spark creates the electric light bulb way back 20,000 years ago, which is then discovered in some tomb and people say, wow, what is that? That's a light that's shining all by itself. And then that technology is forgotten until around about the 19th century, and another fellow comes along and goes, well, I've tried 10,000 experiments, but this one's got to work, and it does, and we've got the electric light bulb. But we had it thousands of years ago, and people wrote about it. Absolutely incredible. I could show you from scripture that we actually had the Ark of Noah with light inside it. Jewish writing tells us that. Oh, that's fascinating. but modern scholarship grants very little credence, if any, to the Mosaic authorship of the Torah. Now, I said the other day when I was giving a previous lecture, you know, how do we know that what we're reading is actually inspired by God? How do we know that it's actually correct? How do we know that we can trust it? How do we know? And just sheer faith in it is not good enough. Otherwise, we may as well say, well, the Bhagavad Gita was inspired, and, you know, look how many Hindus believe in that, and they take it by faith. Or,
The Quran.
Yeah. Or Ohasteh, the Cosmon Bible. You know, you look at that thing and you say, that's a demonically inspired volume. Why do people believe in it? So, we could go on and on and on. So what I'm trying to do in this series of lectures is to show the authenticity of the biblical revelation and why we can trust it based on what we understand from its contents. All right? Not just blind faith, but what we understand from its contents. What can be relevant to us and proven to us as established patterns of thought that are agreeable to us, that work in our daily life. But, you know, many of these Bible critics who say that Moses did not write the Torah, they all claim to be Christians. Let me say this at once, in defense of Moses being the author of those first five scrolls of the biblical revelation, the one on whom I thoroughly depend for my salvation, and the one we praised in song a few minutes ago. And when I say my salvation, I'm talking daily salvation as well as future salvation. Because we're all saved on a daily basis too, believe me. That one on whom I depend on for my salvation spoke of the authority of Moses in relation to the Torah of God on a number of occasions. By name, Yeshua specifically speaks of Moses 6 times in Matthew, 8 times in Mark, 10 times in Luke, 12 times in John. As far as Yeshua is concerned, Moses wrote the Torah. My single authority for Moses being the author of the Torah is Yeshua, the Lord and Savior of the entire universe. That's my authority. That's what I lean on. My confidence is decidedly not in those who cling to the fable of the documentary hypothesis. Yes, let's keep in mind that it's called a hypothesis. It's not a documentary reality, it's a documentary hypothesis. A mere supposition. Theory. Proposed explanation to squirm out of an obedience to the living God, who will take account of the enormous sin of his discreditation. And yes, I know there's no word today called discreditation, but it was used and is still in the dictionary of unused words of the last few hundred years. And I like discreditation. I think it says it all. Just as I like unfaith. Unfaith is a reality. It's a favorite of mine. But you see, I am for raising such wonderful ancient English words from their shallow graves and breathing some new life form into them and bringing them up to date in the 21st century. I think unfaith says more than faithlessness. I think discreditation says more than disaccreditation. Yeah? I don't know, I'm picky on these things, but let's expand our vocabularies so that we can confuse others. Yes, you were going to say something.
I was just going to mention something I heard the other night in a conversation.
Yes.
This is on the air.
Yes.
I think so. And chap on that. They were talking about punctuation.
Yes.
How things have just been dropped off. Mm. And one person mentioned, well, from the old English to now, we'd rarely be able to understand old English.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's
and
true.
Where this comma should be, there never should be a comma and end.
Mm.
And it there was a lot of people came into this.
Yes, yes. Well, there are laws of grammar.
Yeah, laws of grammar.
There are.
Like, that's changed now. You can have a comma.
Yes.
Because we then go on to say, and blah, 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 blah.
Yes, I know, but we write the way we talk.
Said, yes,
you know,
do.
And that's not
that's right.
Right. Yeah. You know, otherwise you may as well have fission, F-I-S-H-I-N, instead of having a G on the end, because a number of people I know that, hey, you're going to go fishing?
Yeah.
What is wrong with asking, do you want to go fishing? Fishing, 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 not fishing.
Going fishing.
Going, yeah. I mean, I do agree there is strife. I do agree with that. And I do think it's a cultural reflection that is genuine. And I think it should be acknowledged as such. It's real.
I called it the evolution of language.
The evolution of language.
Mm-hmm.
We used to watch something, Dennis brought this up recently, on TV. There was a wonderful program that had, it was a series, which talked about the evolving of the English language, with Latin and German and so on and so forth, added to it, and how it evolved. Fascinating stuff. But I love I love etymology. I like to be able to see the root origins of words, where they come from, and taking words apart, having a good look at them, because certain words carry great meaning that we've lost in our modern age, where everything's become so cosmetic. And, you know, I think it's time that we did revive some of the old English. Mind you, some of the... Look, we watch... I love Westerns. All right, I really like a good Western movie. And yet, it's all in modern English. But the people of America in the 18th and 19th century didn't speak like they speak today in Westerns.
Yeah.
They didn't speak that way. Yeah. The closest we came to a reality check on that was the series Deadwood. And they spoke with poetic, almost Elizabethan, almost Shakespearean language forms. And I remember also when our kids were growing up, I used to read them from James Fenimore Cooper. I had a beautiful book. And I used to read them from that, and the kids never understood what I was talking about. So I gave up after about 5 or 6 pages of The Deer Slayer, or The Last of the Mohicans, whatever it was. I gave up because they couldn't equate with the language form of only 100 years ago. 200 years ago. Yeah. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. We do. Speak terribly at times. Like, I'm going home tonight. G-O-W-E-N.
Yeah.
I'm not, I am going.
Yeah.
I am
tonight. Oh, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
No, you're not going to go anywhere. You intend to go, but you're not going to go.
No.
You either go or you don't go.
Yeah.
You're not going to go. Okay.
But don't say going. Anyway, we said,
gonna.
They're
going. Yeah, that's right.
Or gonna do this.
Or gonna.
When I was a child, my mother used to say, you're in the army, are you?
Yeah,
you're
right.
You're going in the army.
But getting back on track, big Julie Valhausen, also emphasised God's two designations as having great meaning in Revelation, in Genesis. God in the first chapter, it's God is known as Elohim, and of course in Genesis 2 verse 4 he becomes Yehovah Elohim, and therefore, as he says, Yahweh Elohim. So he postulated that there are two different authors of Genesis. There was the priestly Elohim document, that's for chapter 1, and then it became expanded in chapter 2 as the Y document, or the J document, actually, for Yahweh or Yahweh. So the two different... Now, there may be some truth in some of this, but what he did was make it the issue. And as soon as he opened that door, these two different authors became a number of different authors, because then we had not just the E and the J document, or priestly caste, or whatever, then came the D and the P, and after that there came a whole lot more. And so suddenly we have Genesis as having relevance as being written only just before virtually the birth of Christ, you know, a few hundred years before Christ was born. And so as time progressed, they say that this one allotment became a merging of a number of documents which became Genesis, and all these documents were not penned by, not, were not written by Moses at all.
So discrediting their authenticity.
Absolutely. And this is why I'm giving this series, because if we want to know what the canon is, and inspiration is, because canon means, you know, that which is we can rely on in relation to our position, be it academic or be it spiritual position, we have to get right back to the nitty-gritty and understand why the arguments are being presented to totally discredit Moses' function in all of this. But you know what? I can say this, that as far as I'm concerned, Moses, when he was in the courts of Pharaoh, the Egyptian courts, because he was learned in all the understanding of the Egyptians. It says that. But you know what he did draw? He, Moses, not some priestly author hundreds of years later, but Moses drew on ancient sources to put Genesis together from the Egyptian courts and libraries. I really believe that. I believe it because it says so. It says so. I'll show you this in a second.
Yeah, I don't understand how people can think of those time periods where here they were building these marvellous temples and monuments and tombs and so on and so forth, and cities which have just been destroyed since then. Why wouldn't they keep their records?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
why wouldn't they have libraries?
Exactly.
If they understood such mathematical genius to put those buildings together...
Mm.
They had to have libraries where knowledge had been written down so that somebody else could come along and take that knowledge and use it.
Well, even in the days of Yeshua, I mean, he was a carpenter.
Mm.
But the word carpenter meant mason as well. So he was a mason, a carpenter, a plumber, an architect. He was all those things. And the state of education at that time in a workable sense, in manual labour areas, was immense, and you had to even understand basics of trigonometry to understand some of these factors. And Yeshua was not just some, you know, you didn't just go out into the wilderness and cut down a few trees and somehow put them together. It all sort of came to be a house, a log cabin. No, it took a lot of understanding and skill and all of that. Yeah. Sorry?
There's a lot of mathematics.
Absolutely.
Nearly all math. Yeah.
My word it is. And but you know, Moses drew on several ancient sources that he had in the Egyptian libraries, and he drew on them and he put together the book of Genesis. If you look at, turn with me to chapter 1 and verse 1 of Genesis. Some of this is a bit of revision because I've talked about this in the past, in the dim past. Genesis 1:1. Which goes right through to chapter 2 and verse 3. So right through to chapter 2 and verse 3. That was called the creation hymn. The creation hymn. And that's where God says, this is who or what I am. All right? And then you have 10 documents that follow the creation hymn. You have 10 documents. And they are entitled the Books of Generations. Just remember that key, the Books of Generations. And which is God's way of stating, this is who you are. Okay, so the very first creation hymn is saying, this is who I am. And then the 10 that follow, the 10 books that follow, this is who you are. 10 of them. Not 9 of them, not 11, there are 10. because this is highly significant, because it is God's intention that the Gentile nations align to him in legal and spiritual matters, because 10 is the number of Torah. this is in numerology, 10 is God's Torah. So God is saying that it's his intention that the Gentile nations align with him in a legal way in spiritual matters. Now, if you go over to, so you've got the opening section here, which is called the creation hymn. But if you go down to chapter 2 and look at verse 4, and I said, you know, remember the terminology, the books of generations, because here in verse 4 it says, "These are the generations of the heavens and of the earth, when they were created, in the day that the Jehovah Elohim made the earth and the heavens." So this begins the next book, which is called the Book of the Generations of the Heavens and the Earth. So that document, as you read through from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through to chapter 4 and verse 26, chapter 4 and verse 26, that's a whole book in itself, and Moses incorporated that, and he called it the Book of the Generations of the Heavens and the Earth. And of course, what follows next is the Book of the Generations of Adam. That's chapter 5, verse 1. So that begins the next book of the generations. So these are books that Moses, they already existed, and Moses simply edited those and incorporated them in his book, the first book of the Torah, which was Genesis. Bereshit. Genesis. Yes.
I find it interesting that you say that that first account up to chapter 2, verse 3, was the song of creation.
Yes.
Because the ancient peoples would sing their history.
Exactly.
And it was passed on
from
generation to generation. A number of people learnt it and sang it
because
you couldn't rely on everybody to survive, you know. And pass it all down. The Aboriginal people said the same thing.
Yes, they did.
They sang routes to go. They sang the trees and the water and the bushes, and so you would know how to get there.
Yes.
And back.
And back. And back.
So I remember years ago there was a Northern European fellow somewhere up around Greenland or Iceland or somewhere like that, and he had all this oral tradition, and with him it was going to die.
Yes.
And he sang this song that went on for days.
It went for days. I remember seeing that.
Was
it Mongolia?
No, it
might have been Mongolia. I'm not sure, but either Iceland or somewhere like that.
Yeah, it was
like
very
that.
Far north.
Far
yes.
north. And he just sang that thing, and he kept singing for days.
Nobody wanted to
People were falling asleep.
Nobody wanted to learn it. Like
no.
We found with the Aboriginal people in Coffs Harbour,
yes.
the lamenting of the older ones because they couldn't pass on the knowledge of the young ones they didn't want to know anymore.
Native Americans did the same thing. The original people they would sing. And absolutely. Yeah, we've lost a lot. We've lost so much.
And singing, we know, passes certain parts of the brain and is incorporated better than just learning things by rote.
Yes. It is it is interesting that as to the generations of the heavens and the earth, the second book, the Book of the Generations of the Heavens and the Earth. I find it very interesting that the Holy Spirit of inspiration refused to allow or permit Moses to discuss the generations of the heavens. He allowed him only to concentrate on the generations of the earth. All right, so he had to concentrate on that, the generations of the earth. The generations of the heavens, were left alone. It was sort of, no, you're not going to talk about that. So he must have had access to it, because he said, you know, these are the generations of the heavens and of the earth, and when they were created. And God says, no, you're not going to talk about the heavens. But Moses is writing it in here, I'm going to talk about both. And God said, nah. From here through the rest of the Genesis, it's the generations of the earth, not the generations of the heavens. And to this day, we're still saying, we need to find out what's out there. We need to know what's going on out there. What are these UFOs? What are these? What's that? Yeah, we don't know.
So from chapter 4:25,
yes.
right through Genesis, the, this is book of Adam, or where?
The generations. The generations of the book of the generations of Adam. Yeah, that begins in chapter 5 and verse 1. It begins in chapter 5 and verse 1 because it says this is the book of the generations of Adam. So that begins that book. But it goes right through to chapter 6 and verse 8. Verse 8 says of chapter 6, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. All right. So then if you go to the very next verse, verse 9, these are the generations of Noah. This is the book of the generations of Noah, as it should be. So you've got the book of the you've got the creation hymn, then you've got 10 that follow. You've got the generations of the heavens and the earth, but Moses is only allowed to write about the earth. And then you've got the book of the generations of Adam, and then you've got the book of the generations of Noah. Now that goes from chapter 6 and verse 9 all the way through to chapter 9 and verse 28. And remember, these are all books. These are all actual books that Moses has incorporated, and he calls them the book of the generations of this one and that one. So all the way through to 9, verse 28 and 29, you might say. Okay. Then you have the very next book, verse 1 of chapter 10, the very next book is the book of the generations of the sons of Noah. So he's incorporated that volume, the book of the generations of the sons of Noah. And that goes from chapter 10, in verse 1, through to 11 and verse 9. Verse 9. And directly following that, in verse 10, this is the book of the generations of Shem. That's the next one. That's the next one. And that goes from chapter 11, verse 10, all the way through to verse 26. It ends with...
In chapter 11.
And chapter 11. So it's a very short book, that one. I don't know what he cut out of it, because by comparison to the others, it's quite short. But clearly he did some very heavy editing. He finishes with the introduction of Abram in verse 26. But then, verse 27, the book of the generations of Terah. Now here, Terah was the father of Abram. Now that goes from verse 27 all the way through, this is quite a lengthy one, to chapter 25 and verse 11. Chapter 25 and verse 11, which says, it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Yitzhak, or Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well, Laharai. All right. But then the very next verse, this is the book of the generations of Ishmael. So here's the next book, the book of the generations of Ishmael. That's Genesis chapter 25 and verse 12. But it's also very short. Finishes in verse 18. And after that, and don't forget, now you've got the book of the generations of Adam, Noah, sons of Noah, Shem, Terah, Ishmael. Now, it says in verse 19 of chapter 25, this is the book of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. All right? Now, not Abraham's firstborn son. The firstborn son of Sarah, this is, you know, not Abraham. Abraham's firstborn son was Ishmael. I've heard so many Messianic Jews say, you know, Isaac was Abraham's firstborn. No, he wasn't. No, he was not. He was Sarah's firstborn. Isaac was Sarah's firstborn. All right. So the generations of Isaac, that's Genesis 25, verse 19. It goes all the way to chapter 35. All the way to chapter 35. And verse 29. So all Moses was doing through here was copying what was in the Egyptian archives and editing as he went through. So Genesis 35 and verse 29, which is the end of the chapter of 35, it says, Isaac gave up the ghost and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. All right, so that was the generations of Isaac. Then the next one, the ninth book of the generation, constellates around Esau. This is the book of the generations of Esau, who is Edom. So Moses talks about this in chapter 36 and verse 1. Down to verse 43, which is the end of the chapter of chapter 36. And then follows the final volume that Moses has put together to create Genesis. You'll find in verse 2 of chapter 37, this is the book of the generations of Jacob. And all the way through, and this goes from chapter 37, verse 2, all the way through to chapter 50 and verse 26. Chapter 50 and verse 26 is where it says Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him and put him in a coffin in Egypt. So Moses seems to have a peculiarity of ending each of the generation, the book of the generations, with someone's death. All right? So he was sort of like the Stephen King of yore, of ancient times. So here you've got all these different books of the generations of people so that we understand who the Gentiles are. If we take the book of Genesis and put it to one side, then we have no idea of who these nations are that are talked about in the prophets, in the major prophets and in the minor prophets. The Edomites, the Assyrians, the Nabataeans, and so on and so forth. They're all mentioned here in the 10 books of the generations that Moses inculcated into Genesis. And in fact, as to the final volume, this is the book of the generations of Jacob, its contents reveal how much the people of Israel are indebted to the Gentiles. Genesis is not about the Jews, it's all about the Gentiles, really, until you get to near the end and talks about Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and all that, and Joseph. But before that, it's all about the various nations of the world of that time, and how Israel was dependent upon Gentile blessings, how the Gentiles participated in Israel's activities and privileges, I might add. Note that I said originally that the 10 Chronicles were incorporated into Genesis, which itself is the first book of the law. It's the first book of the Torah. Right? And here the Gentiles are given a priority over the Jews. A priority over the Jews in God's inspired record. And when people say, you know, Gosling, you emphasize Jewish thought form to the max. Yes, I do. But I do not exclude in any way, shape or form the Gentiles. Never have. And, the Gentiles were included in the very first book of the law. And this is because God loved humanity so much, he gave them laws too. Not just to Israel. He also gave laws to the Gentiles for their general care and well-being. And these laws are called by Jewish scholars the seven Noahide commandments. The seven Noahide commandments. And the seven laws of Noah are applicable to every Gentile that's ever been born, that's ever lived. and I have to smile sometimes when I hear people say, oh, well, you know, God's people, Israel, they've got all these laws, but we don't have any. We don't have any laws. Oh, really? The seven Noahide laws are binding upon all humanity. I don't care who they are, but particularly Gentiles. Law number one, all people should believe in one God and abstain from idolatry. That was the first law that applied to every Gentile. The second, everyone should be moral and refrain from adultery and incest. I agree with that. Absolutely. The third law, people should be useful members of society and should not commit murder. And the fourth law, everyone should be honest and refrain from stealing. Notice how these are very similar to the Ten Commandments. There's seven of them. The fifth law, people should respect God and never blaspheme. Sixth, law courts should be maintained to settle disputes with justice. Seventh, people should be kind to animals. I find that interesting. People should be kind to animals. And this apparently refers to the pagan practice of tearing the limbs off living animals and eating them while they're still alive. Okay? Yeah. So these seven laws are binding upon all of humanity. And they're included in the Torah when God gave it to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. And the Torah testifies that these commandments were indeed those God gave man from the outset of creation and is therefore the ultimate source of their authority. So it's one thing for the world to say, oh, look, we don't want Moses. They don't want Moses because, number one, Moses is identified with Sinai. Sinai is identified with laws, rules and regulations, and people say, we don't want rules and laws and regulations. But, okay, you don't want that, fine. But there are seven laws and rules and regulations that God requires of all human beings. Now, of course, I disagree with the rabbinic authorities on this matter of the number of seven. In fact, I think there are possibly eight and probably nine. In fact, if I look even hard enough, I'll find a tenth to correspond to the Ten Commandments, if I look hard enough. But this is an aside. As to the name of city-states, towns and regions by designations created long after Moses lived and died, and here is a problem, all right? So here is an issue. In the Torah, we find the names of city-states, towns and regions called by certain designations only long after Moses was dead. Therefore, how could Moses have included those names in there? Because he wasn't around. That's the argument. Well, it's very simply that I can lay credit for that apparent anomaly by citing the editing accomplished in his day and age by Ezra. People forget about Ezra. He died in 312 BCE, so 312 years before Christ was born, Ezra died. And Ezra did the final editing, so he brought certain names up to date for his population of Jews that lived at the time when he was alive, so that they would know who Moses was talking about when he wrote of these ancient names which no longer were in use. But Ezra knew what they were, and he brought them up to date. It's very simple. So the documentary hypothesis fails in that area as well, as far as I'm concerned. Ezra was known as Malachi the prophet. You'll find that in the Targum Yonatan, Rabbanu Shananel Megillah, in Rashi, in the Tosafot, in Ketuvot 16a, Yevamot 86b, etc., etc., etc. The Jewish scholars and scribes all know that Malachi was Ezra. And Ezra brought the Torah up to speed to the absurd claim made by later authors of the Torah than Moses, placing the creation of the Torah around 500 BCE. I disrespectfully disagree. Now, it never fails to disappoint me when friends and acquaintances point out to me that my early lecture, which I then turned into an article at a later date, entitled Ancient Records Reconsidered, I think you've all read Ancient Records Reconsidered, they say it was in flagrant error when I make mention of the identity of the Pharaoh of the Exodus, which conflicts with the name Ramses, or Ramses, given a number of times in the Torah. Now, if you have a look in the Torah, turn to Genesis for a start, and have a look at Genesis chapter 47 and verse 11. Genesis 47 and verse 11. It says, and this is Moses writing, it says, "And Joseph placed his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded." So there's a mention of Ramses, or Ramses if you wish, right there in Genesis 47 and verse 11. And then over in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 11, remember, Moses is writing this. He writes in verse 11, "They therefore did set over Israel taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities." And then he names them Python and Ramses. Python and Ramses. Or Ramses. So there's another mention of Ramses. There's another mention of Ramses. And then if you go over to Exodus 12 and look at verse 37, "The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot that were men besides children." So there's mention again of Ramses. And over in Numbers, in the fourth book of the Torah, Numbers 33, Numbers 33, and look at verse 3, Numbers 33 and verse 3, "They departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with a high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians." That's in verse 3. And you drop down to verse 5. "The children of Israel removed from Ramses and pitched in Succoth." So it is assumed by the, by most people who study the Bible, that the Pharaoh of Egypt at the time of the Exodus was Ramses. Because there it is in plain black and white, that the Ramses, there is his name, there's his name. And but you know, Ramses is not, decidedly not, the Pharaoh of the Exodus. No, not at all. Yet his name does appear in Exodus and Numbers and early in Genesis.
But this is a place called Ramses.
Yes, it is. But the very fact that Ramses' name is there and his city is there.
I hadn't finished. This is a place, which means that usually you don't name places after people until they're dead. Either dead or pretty old.
Or they're pretty,
Clues in Genesis.
Well, there's a lot of clues. I'm going to go through them in a minute. But I will say this: Moses never attributed that name to that particular ruler of Egypt or to the region of Ramses, whether it's a city,
it's a
city
leap
state,
in the dark that they've taken, really, isn't it?
It is, but you know, I'll come with.
Oh, here's his name. It's got to be him.
It's got to be him. That's right. In the case of Genesis, in Genesis 47:11, Bible commentaries tell us that the land of Ramses, which this is interesting. Even Bible commentaries recognize this. If you turn over to Genesis 46, this is rather interesting. Genesis 46. And look at verse 34. Bible commentaries tell us that the land of Ramesses was originally known as the land of Goshen. Now, if you look at verse 34, let's read what it says. You shall say, your servant's trade has been about cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. But here's the land of Goshen. But Bible commentaries say that that was the original name of the land of Ramesses. All right, so we've got the original land of Ramesses was called Goshen at the time of Israel's sojourn. Yes?
I grew up in a part of Manaf in a suburb called Kogra, which has now been divided up, and where I grew up is now called Monterey.
Yes. Yes.
But it's in the district of St. George.
Yes.
In the Illawarra.
That's right.
Of Greater Sydney.
Greater Sydney.
Of New South Wales, Australia. Australia.
Yeah, that's right, yes, that's right. Yes. Yes, I know. So where do you come from?
My name is Montego Toya, yes, or whatever the thing.
Yes.
It was the richest fertile place.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Which is why God blessed them with it,
yeah,
to Egypt. But these Bible commentators usually add it was later known as the Field of Zoan. Z-O-A-N. The Field of Zoan. So it was called Goshen, it became Ramesses, and later Zoan. So here are three name changes to the one region, which was east of Memphis. That's not Memphis, Tennessee, that's Memphis. We can get very technical here. But this was prior to its becoming known as Ramesses, a pharaoh who claimed the Egyptian throne as a Hyksos king from the Amu tribal peoples. The Amu, as Israel left Egypt after Egypt was devastated by the plagues, the pharaoh let them go, and then he chased them. And of course you had the Red Sea event, and then Israel was in the wilderness. The first time they have a conflict is with a huge army, which ancient historians said was about 400,000 in number. Now that's a mighty army. And they were marching toward, and with camels and horses and so on, they were going into Egypt. And they were called the Amu people in history. So they became known as the Hyksos kings. The people that Israel met coming in to destroy Egypt and then to take over Egypt for 500 years were Amalekites, red-headed Esau people, red-headed Amalekites. And they swarmed into devastated Egypt, and oh my, did Egypt pay for its dealings with Israel in a most horrendous way. But Ezra, here we come back to Ezra. Ezra, in updating the Torah especially, changed the original text to the appellation it was widely known at the time of his editing. I will say this. If you look back here, and I find this rather fascinating, where am I? It's Genesis 47:11. Genesis 47:11. I do find this rather intriguing. That's not it. Exodus 1:11, maybe. Exodus 1:11. Hang on. Exodus 1 and verse 11, maybe that's it. Yes. It says, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Ramesses, and one called Pai Thong. Now, this has puzzled scholars for centuries. Pai Thong. It is rather intriguing that the name of the pharaoh who was never ever found, right, his body was never recovered, drowned, and yet one of the Egyptian records talks about His Majesty leaped into the place of the whirlpool, so they recognise that he drowned in water, but he was never recovered. His name was Thong, T-H-O-N, or Thaum, T-H-O-U-M. And there's even a little, what do you call it, head carving in the British Museum,
statuette
of the head. And you'll find him in the British Museum, a picture of this pharaoh of the exit. We saw it, remember, earlier. Rather interesting that they, for some reason, they did not update that name, the treasure city of Pai Thong, and that was named after the pharaoh of the Exodus, which is rather I find that very, very fascinating. But for dumb clucks, okay, for dumb clucks like Cecil B. DeMille, who was not a biblical student, he was a wonderful cinematographer and director and all of that, but he took the recorded name Ramses, which I've just read so many times, he took that name and assumed from the biblical record that he therefore had to be the pharaoh who lived during the Exodus. And after the movie The Ten Commandments was released, an entire generation worldwide who saw the film adopted that same assumption without ever questioning its authenticity. And I would not be able to sit down and watch The Ten Commandments now without being critical of that aspect of it. And despite superior critical findings by eminent biblical scholars, like the one I quoted at the very beginning, Deva, of a very late dating for the creation of the five books of Torah, and also indeed as an entire falsification and or fabrication of the history of Israel. You see, this is the real motive of these people who are Bible critics. They want to falsify the history of Israel. They want to do away with Jewishness in the Bible. They're getting rid of Jewishness everywhere that now. It's we've gone from the time of popularity to be a Jew to hide your kippah. All right, and that's a fact. And but they've fabricated the history of Israel now, totally fabricated it. And the Palestinians are the leading guardians of this monstrous anti-Semitic BS, because that's what it is, nothing less. Centuries post Moses, especially the book of Deuteronomy, but there are indications within the scroll of Exodus itself that the clamour for exposure of the sort that would date the written script record of the escape from Egypt not only to the period of Moses, but which reads almost like an on-the-spot diary entry. I can show you something in a minute to prove that the Bible was written by, the Torah was written by Moses. It's rather interesting. Something has been overlooked by these eminent Bible critics concerning the dating of Deuteronomy, particularly. And I'm going to show you that. I'm going to share that with you. I want you to look, in fact, I'll show you now. I want you to look very closely at Leviticus 11 and make it a study for this week. Make it a study. Look at the list of animals that you can eat and animals you can't eat in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. Because the biblical record in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 gives you two classes in content list of animals that are clean and those which are shunned as unfit for human digestion, and yet in that is an unseen gem, I might call it, of hidden truth about the time when it was written. It's been overlooked by scholars galore. So make a note, Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14, so that later on you can get your concordances out, you can get your Bible study guides out, you can go through the two lists, and you can find the differences in the lists. But before I go any further on it, I want to make an observation. Most Christians are blissfully unaware that the Torah injunctions concerning foods that can be eaten and creatures that are forbidden is the third category. It's the third category to be found in the biblical revelation about foods. It's the third category. There were two previous announcements by God regarding what you can eat, what you can't eat. Rather interesting. The first two sets of regulations are to be found as given by God to Adam. People overlook that. They don't read it properly. And after the deluge, to Noah, respectively. So God gave advice to Adam, very sound advice, and advice to Noah.
Are they the same advice?
Sorry?
Are they the same advice?
No, they're different as well. They're different. It's rather interesting because the biblical revelation concentrating on diet reveals God's desire for his human creatures made in his image to eat correctly. All right? There's no, God is very... God's really interested in us, human beings. Even in that degree of what goes in our gut. It really is. If you have a look at Genesis, and have a look at Genesis chapter 1, you know, because regulations shared by God, the living God, as to appropriate indulgences of such a nature, to be found right at the very start of human history, right at the creation, and you can't get any further back than that, tell us much about God's concern for our ongoing physical welfare. Now have a look at this. Verse 24, chapter 1. God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creatures after its kind, cattle, creeping thing, beast of the earth after his kind." It was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps upon the earth after its kind. God saw it was good. Then he says, "Have dominion over the fish and the fowl and the cattle, over all the earth upon which creepy things creep." Then, if you look further down at verse 29, God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed." That you want to have good, clean food? There's capsicum. Open that up. What's a berry? Seed. You like kiwi fruit? Chew into it? What are you chewing into? It's bearing seed. All right. He says, "Behold, I have given you every plant, or every herb, bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, in which is the fruit of a tree, yielding seed." And rather interesting, you can go out into our outback or into our bush in Australia, and you'll find trees that have fruit on it. You wouldn't touch it, number one, because the Aboriginals will say, "You can't eat that. You can't eat that, because it doesn't have seed." All right? Fact. So he says it will be for you for food. And this is rather interesting. They say, "Well, everything is edible." No, God says anything that's growing that has seed. Now, poison ivy and all the other stuff, you wouldn't touch it. So he's saying, beware of a lot of this. He says in verse 30, "To every beast of the earth, to every fowl of the air, to everything that creeps upon the earth wherein there is life, I have given every green plant for food." Alright? Rather interesting. So here was the very first detail of God's concern for humanity. He says, eat fruit, eat plants, eat herbs, as long as the seed is in it. If the seed's not in it, don't touch it. You know what that tells me? There are certain plants you shouldn't eat. There are certain plants you shouldn't eat for food. They are for other purposes, not food. And and it's rather interesting, that advice about what to eat and what not to eat at the very beginning, at creation week, for Adam and Eve, is a directive given by God prior to God summing up in satisfaction of the work of his hands in creation. Because if you look where it is, it's only after that that God says, and I look at all, I look at it all, and it's wonderful. It's really great what I've done. Okay? But the direction for food is given before he utters his vocal satisfaction with his creation. I find that interesting. In any event, most interpreters are of the opinion that both Torah food regulation lists, both of them, are essentially identical to one another. And if you read a cursory reading, you'll read through both and go, yeah, that's the same. No, it's not the same. It's not the same. If you start listing all the animals and all the fish and all of that and the fowl, you'll find that, no, the lists are different. But Seventh-day Adventists have a lot of literature, and I've read a lot of it, and you'd think the two lists were the same. No, they're not. They're not. Scholars have argued for years that they are different, and they are correct. They are different. The common consequence of noting these differences is for the scholars to then argue back and forth as to which list in the scrolls came first. Was it Leviticus or Deuteronomy? Or was it Deuteronomy versus Leviticus? For that argument, they also say, well, there could be a third source from which both authors, the author of Leviticus and the author of Deuteronomy, or authors of both, drew their conclusions. A third source. What was that? We don't know. Well, how do you know there was one? Well, it could be. And this is their inane argument. But they say the authors profusely borrowed from creation accounts. Well, I've done my research on all of that, and I'll give you a couple of good sources if you want to go to them. Royden K. Yerkes, The Unclean Animals of Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, from the Jewish Quarterly Review, Volume 14, Number 1, in 1923. Wendy Ann Wilkenfeld, who wrote Food Regulation in Biblical Law, a paper submitted in satisfaction of the written work requirement of Harvard Law School. I mean, these aren't religious fanatics. These are very schooled people and very scholastic people, academics. That was in 1998. Nathan MacDonald, Not Bread Alone, The Uses of Food in the Old Testament, Oxford University Press, 2008. These are volumes that I have gained from in finding the differentiation between the two lists, and they are different. A lot of similarity, but most of them are different. And there's a reason for it. And this is the hidden gem, the hidden key that I might have shared to prove that they were written by Moses at the time of the Exodus. And I'll explain this in a second. In my view, which was also Dr. Ernest Martin's consideration, the variances focus on what was at the time experienced by the Israelites in their early wanderings from Egyptian captivity. If you look at the two lists and you see the differences in them, it's clear that what was being written at the time like a diary event, because it shows a difference in the emphasis of the animal kind. Martin puts it elegantly. He says, the book of Numbers was the journal of Israel's trek through the wilderness. The last entry, chapter 36, was written by Moses at the conclusion of 40 years, along with Deuteronomy, which was produced within the last 60 days. And you go, well, how does he know that? All right. Open your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 3. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 3. Why I'm emphasizing this is because the popularity of the documentary hypothesis needs to be put to one side. You've got to get an argument against it to be considered any kind of studious student. Deuteronomy 1 verse 3, you will find, it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, how specific Moses is, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all the Lord had given him in commandment unto them. Now, look at that. Now, go over to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34. Bearing that first reference in mind, hop over to Deuteronomy 34. And Moses went up from the plains of Moab to the mountains of Nebo to the top of Pisgah and over against Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead to Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Yehuda to the utmost sea, in the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, unto Zoar. And the Lord said unto him, this is the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, I will give it unto your seed. I have caused you to see it with your own eyes, but you shall not go over. That would be awful to experience that rebuke. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor. But no man knows of his sepulchre to this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, his natural force, nor his natural force abated. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended. And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him. And the children of Israel hearkened to him, as the Lord commanded Moses. And there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent to him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, and to all his servants, to all his land, and all the mighty hand, and in all the great terror which Moses showed in the sight of all Israel. Notice the timing in this element here, in Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy was formulated for a special reason. It was intended to teach Israel further laws and statutes that they would need to know when they settled in the promised land. Almost all the laws in Deuteronomy, now please make a note, mental note on paper on this, all the laws in Deuteronomy, can't even get the word out, pertain to an agricultural economy, not one within a desert or wilderness environment. As evidence of this, Martin says, notice the types of animals recorded in Deuteronomy 14. In comparing them with Leviticus 11, there are many differences in the animals mentioned. Now notice, in Leviticus, the animals were generally those native to the wilderness. Animals which Israel encountered south and east of Palestine. Yes, as they were coming out of Egypt, they saw certain animals.
Of what?
Sorry?
Of what? Palestine.
Yes, well...
No such place.
No, there's no such place as Palestine, but I'm using, and Martin is using the terminology that it was before Israel became. How do you explain it? Did you say Canaan? You wanted, what would you call that area? What would you call that area? It was all Syria, for that matter. But when? Hundreds of years later. That's all right. No, I don't have a problem with that. But the animals Israel encountered south and east of Palestine, while in Deuteronomy, and here's the point, while in Deuteronomy, the animals were located in more habitable and civilized areas of the Fertile Crescent, which point you made earlier. Oh, so that area... was fertile. It was extremely fertile. And you'll find a different list of animals. Those that are peculiar to the Fertile Crescent, not those peculiar to south and east of, call it what you will, Syria, or you can call it the land of the Philistines, or you can call it the land of Canaan, you can call it whatever you want. But, or Palestine, that area there, before Israel became a nation. So the animals were located in that area of the Fertile Crescent in the Deuteronomy list. That's the difference. Why is there a difference? Because in Leviticus, it is talking about those animals that they could see. So here is the diary event showing the time of writing. The diary event, as he's going through, he's mentioning the animals that they knew along the highway. In Deuteronomy, he's talking about the animals when they moved into that area that they were going to eventually settle after fighting Canaanites. And if anybody has a claim to the land, it's the Canaanites, because they were there first. So he adds, these variations do not show evidences of different authorship. Absolutely, I agree with him. That's the same author, and he's recording what they saw as they left. It's a script that is vital to the understanding of the proof of authenticity of the Torah written by Moses. How do I know that? Because by the time you get to Ezra, 300 BCE, or to the 700th, the 7th century, 6th and 7th century before the birth of Christ, when they say the documentary hypothesis was finally formulated, that's what Wellhausen claimed. Those animals in the area of Egypt no longer existed, but we know they existed from script, hieroglyphs, and so on and so forth, showing an early recording of the Torah. The book of Deuteronomy, he says, was a rephrasing or reapplication of the basic laws given in the wilderness, which made them more appropriate for a settled land economy. You see, obviously. That's Martin's book, Restoring the Original Bible, 1994, page 149. So these were eyewitness evaluations for the revealed word of God, the God who led them out of the slime pits of bondage. But, now here is my but, there is a very simple method which anybody can use who can access the age of the Torah. Get a copy of your Bible concordance or your Bible dictionary, or go to Google and put in Jerusalem. Just write in Jerusalem in the Bible. Or Zion, or Zion, as it's properly called. Type that in. Zion in the Bible. I didn't bother going to Google. I simply went to my Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, and I looked up the first reference to Zion, or Zion. I find it in 2 Samuel 5, verse 7. Nowhere near the Torah. 2 Samuel 5, verse 7. The very first reference to Jerusalem. And when I put in Zion, because Zion and Sion are usually in the same place, a Z and an S, I found one actually in Deuteronomy 4, verse 48. But it's speaking not of Jerusalem, it's speaking of Mount Hermon, which is called Sion, with an S, which is a snow-capped ridge situated on the Lebanon-Syria border west of Damascus. I thought, now this is interesting. This sparked my curiosity. Mount Hermon is where the gods came, where Yeshua took the apostles, and they saw it had the transfiguration and all of that, where in Genesis 6 the gods come down and they mate with human women. It's the highest point on the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea. So even from Jerusalem, on a clear day, you can see Mount Hermon way in the distance. You can see. It was Ezra who gave the final editing to the Torah and to the entire Bible, who is granted as giving the designated Hermon as Mount Sion, or Sion, in the 4th century BCE, long after Israel settled Canaan. Farrah Fenton, in his Bible translation, propounds the Ezra interpolation. In other words, he says, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 41 to 48 was not a part of the text of Moses, and the Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 9, speaking of Shirion or Shania, and both texts were added by the editor Ezra. If you want to have a look at Deuteronomy 3, verse 9, have a look at this. It's rather interesting. He says in verse 9 of chapter 3 of Deuteronomy, Hermon, the Sidonians call Sirion. See how interesting that is? It's almost like Sion. Sirion. And the Amorites call it Shenir or Senir. So you've got this very similar word as Sion. It's very similar. Or Sion. Very similar. But Rabbi Hertz, talking about Deuteronomy 3:9, and also, well, have a look at Deuteronomy 4:48 as well. Deuteronomy 4, verse 48. Deuteronomy 4, verse 48. Well, verse 47. Israel possessed the land in the land of Og, king of Bashan, two kings of the Amorites, who were on this side of Jordan toward the sunrise, from Aroer, which is by the bank of the river Arnon, even unto Mount Sion, or Sion, which is Hermon. All right? Verse 48. Now, Rabbi Hertz, who was the late great rabbi of the British Empire, wrote, Mount Sion is not to be confused with Mount Zion. All right? Not to be confused. For the spelling of both in the Hebrew script is different to the usual English. So much so, when we translate Hebrew into English, we get which Hermon, the Sidonians, call Sirion, and the Amorites call it Senir. And then he adds a postscript in the form of an archaeological note. He says, the several names in the text, as also that of Sion, are all descriptive. Rising with its grey snow-capped cone to a height of 9,500 feet, it is visible from most parts of the Promised Land, and even from the depths of the Jordan Valley and the shores of the Dead Sea. Hence it was Sion, or Sion, the upraised, or Hermon, the lofty peak, or Senir, or Sirion, the glittering breastplate of ice, and above all, Lebanon, the Mont Blanc of Palestine, the white mountain of ancient times. Now, he's taking exception to translations that had Zion in there, because as he's saying, it's not. It's Sion or Sion, which is a derivative of these other names, Sirion, etc. Hertz's scholarship is verified by the New Revised Standard Version and the Jerusalem Bible, among others, and J.N. Darby's translation on Deuteronomy 3:9 is followed by Moffat. But now search for Jerusalem. Where is the very first mention of this vitally important Jewish city in the Bible, a city which is never mentioned anywhere in the Muslim Quran? Where is the name Jerusalem mentioned first in the Bible? It's in the book of Joshua. All right? Moses is dead. So Moses couldn't have written about this. It's in Joshua. If it's in Joshua, I must state the flaming obvious. Jerusalem never appears anywhere from Genesis to Deuteronomy. Stop and think for a minute. Jerusalem and Zion are the most important names any Jew could attach to. Only after Moses is dead and Joshua is fully in charge of the people of Israel do we locate a mention of the famous city. Then, and only then, Jerusalem is mentioned 655 times in the Hebrew scriptures, 146 times in the Messianic scriptures, and a staggering number of 229 times in the Book of Kingdoms, that is, Kings and Chronicles. Just think about it. Jerusalem, 655 times, 146 times in the New Testament, 229 times in Kings and Chronicles, but never mentioned once in Torah. Why? Who can answer this? Why isn't it mentioned in the Torah?
Probably because it hadn't been done.
Exactly. It hadn't even been built. You see, here is the evidence. Not only do we have the two lists of birds, fish, and reptiles and animals, two different, because they identify two different areas as they wandered, but the fact is, Moses had never heard of Jerusalem. And the same is true of Zion, or Zion, with a single instance exception in most English versions of the text, to which I've referred, and that one lone instance is an apparent later updated one made by Ezra in his day and age when Mount Hermon on the Lebanon-Syria border was viewed as Mount Sion or Zion. In this recognition, I'm doing my best to grant a clarification to the biblical scholars who would like to disagree with Rabbi Hertz in his Pentateuch and Haftorahs. Jerusalem and Zion are located right throughout the Hebrew scriptures, but Moses never made note of that city because it didn't exist when he wrote. Had he done so, there is little doubt he would have mentioned Jerusalem and Zion or sought opportunity to inculcate them at various points, vital points, in his various addresses to Israel. And remember, the Bible is full of Moses' addresses to Israel, all the way through the Torah.
Two kings.
Yes. Yes.
That's my first reference.
Yes, it's mentioned all the way through 229 times in Kings and Chronicles. So, put it this way. There exist 80,000 Hebrew words in the Torah. 80,000 single Hebrew words in the Torah. But Jerusalem and Zion are totally absent. One Christian author muses, quote, modern scholars would have us believe the editor priests consciously edited, collated, and massaged the entire Torah over the centuries when their attachment to Jerusalem was at its height, and they produced the entire Torah without ever using the words Jerusalem or Zion once. These are the editors that are supposed to be the people who are incorporated into the documentary hypothesis, all right? These editors were living in Jerusalem while this editing was going on, and this while they were concurrently compiling the other books, Kings, Chronicles, Samuel, etc., that used Jerusalem over 600 times and Zion over 100 times, unquote. Yeah, he's saying there's an anomaly here. If they were doing the entire editing of the Hebrew scriptures, and it includes the Torah, why is the Torah absent of these names? When it was on every Jew's lips, Jerusalem. If I forget your hand, if I forget your name,
may my hand forget its skill
and my tongue its cunning. Yeah. All right? Yeah. Okay. He adds, I find my faith to be way too small and way too weak to believe such an utterly fantastic idea. Revisionist scholars, for whatever reason, fail to note these obvious yet simple facts standing right before their eyes. They claim to be able to observe and interpret facts as minute as fern seeds, yet they cannot see the elephant in the room. The Pentateuch, with its absolute silence on both Jerusalem and Zion, must have been finalized before the rise of the monarchy in 1000 BC. As pseudo-Moses' editorial team would not have passed over the opportunity to use Jerusalem and Zion in compiling their Torah while Jerusalem was their keystone, unquote. I cannot but be in total agreement in this matter.
Even the Torah was kept in a tabernacle at Shiloh, not not in Jerusalem.
It was not established. David, King David, was the one that took this
took it from there and built
a city.
Yes.
Of course, it goes without saying that the want of the terms Jerusalem and Zion from the records of Moses in the Torah does not necessarily intend to imply that Moses was the actual author of these five sacred scrolls, obviously. It does mean, nevertheless, that these records, the five scrolls of Torah, were penned prior to the Jewish establishment of Jerusalem as their capital, and thereby dismantles the idea that the Torah was written long after the death of Moses. Indeed, as Deva says at the very beginning, I quoted it, it was inserted not earlier than the late 7th century BCE. You know, how dare they? As far as the written script of the Torah is concerned, we can be assured it was penned, as the Bible makes candidly plain, by its author Moses, and it was delivered in its original five scrolls into the hands of the priests, the Levites, for generational safekeeping. If you look at Deuteronomy, I'll repeat it again, I did last time, I gave a lecture on this, lecture two. Have a look at Deuteronomy again, chapter 31 and verse 9. It says very clearly, Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, who bear the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, and unto all the elders of Israel. He handed it over. He wrote Torah. He wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and he handed it over, and they put it as the custodians of the Torah into the side of the Ark, where they had built a little satchel for it. He delivered it into the safekeeping. He canonized it. He canonized the Torah. He put it into the hands of the priests, the sons of Levi, for generational safekeeping. That is to say, it was acknowledged as possessing spiritual canonicity. This concludes the present lecture, and the next one will be even more intriguing and more interesting. We will commence that, hopefully, from Modern Hospital, in two more weeks.